Thank you very much, Luke, and good morning, everyone. You know, it's a great pleasure to be here. It's especially good to be able to join you in person. This is the first time since February that I've been able to speak to a room full of people. So I hope it's a sign that the worst is behind us and things are starting to return to normal and that a recovery is now underway. Today I would like to talk about that recovery and four of the factors that are likely to influence it. The first of these is how successful we are in containing the virus. The second is how effectively we deal with the shadow of a very uneven recession. The third is how willing people and businesses are to draw on their accumulated financial buffers to spend and invest. And the fourth and final thing I want to talk about is economic policy, including monetary policy. As we all know, the past 7 months have been incredibly difficult ones in the life of our nation. I think they're months that we'll always remember, won't we? Our lives have been affected in waves that were barely imaginable at the start of the year, and the economic policy response has also been on a scale that was barely imaginable back in January. At a very high level, that response has had two parts. The first was to build a bridge to the day when the pandemic is contained and to get as many people and businesses across that bridge as possible. The second part of the response has been to construct the road to the recovery as the economy opens up. In my view, this has been the right strategy. It's involved the government, the RBA, the regulators and the banks working very closely together in the national interest. Thanks to this effort and the progress on the health front, our recovery is now underway in Australia, and we can look forward to that recovery continuing. That's clearly good news, but the shape and the nature of that recovery remains highly uncertain. Much depends upon how, as a society, we can live with the virus and the success of the scientists in terms of vaccine, antiviral treatments and rapid testing. There has been positive news on these fronts recently, and we do hope for more positive news, but realistically, success is not yet assured. So the single most important influence on the recovery is how successful we are in containing the virus. I now want to move to a second factor that will shape the recovery, and that's the shadow cast by the very uneven nature of the recession that we've been living through. We all know all recessions are uneven, but this one has been especially so. The government has wisely sought to even things out, but inevitably we are left with outcomes that are very uneven across the country. This unevenness is especially evident in the labour market, so this is where I'd like to focus. This first chart shows the fall in employment that occurred between February and May for different age groups and the recovery through to August. I think the picture's pretty clear. The job losses have been largest for young people, with around 500,000 people under 35 losing their jobs in the early stages of the pandemic, and around 300,000 were still out of work in August. This heavy burden partly reflects the uneven way that the pandemic has affected different industries. You can see this in this next chart. The hospitality sector, in which many young people and women work, was worst affected, with almost 300,000 job losses between February and May. There has been an encouraging recovery of late, and for this to be sustained, the economy is going to need to open up further. In contrast to the hospitality sector, a number of other sectors have been much less affected. That include the finance sector, the public sector, and the mining and parts of agriculture. One consequence of these developments is that people who work in lower paid occupations have, on average, been the hardest hit. You can see this in this graph, which shows the decline in employment has been largest for occupations with the lowest average hourly earnings, while employment has actually increased for occupations with the highest hourly earnings. I think this difference in experience is striking. The uneven effect of the pandemic is also evident in small businesses being harder hit on average than large businesses. As you can see here, as at mid-September, the number of people on the payrolls of firms with at least 200 employees was down just 1% on the level in mid-March. In contrast, payrolls are down 7% on average for firms with between 20 and 200 employees, and there's been a similar decline for firms with fewer than 20 employees. This divergence in experience between large and small firms is also evident in the retail spending data. As you can see here, spending at large firms is up considerably, but spending at small firms has only just returned to the level before the pandemic. Many retailers selling items such as home office equipment, electronics and groceries have done pretty well, but cinemas and many restaurants have had a very difficult time. So the experience across the economy has been very uneven. The pandemic has also hit our states and territories quite differently. As is evident in this graph, in the first couple of months, all jurisdictions were affected broadly in the same way, with the number of payroll jobs falling between 7 and 9% almost everywhere. Since then, labour market conditions have diverged very significantly. As you can see, the recovery has been strongest in Western Australia, so much so that in our business liaison in Perth, we're hearing reports of some labour shortages in specific areas. Consistent with the labour market data, retail spending, consumer confidence and house building have also picked up by more in Western Australia than elsewhere. At the other end of the distribution is Victoria, where the second wave has meant that the early recovery in jobs has been reversed, with the number of jobs there still down 8% from the level in March. Retail spending in Victoria in August was also 11% lower than at the start of the year. In contrast, spending in the rest of the country was 13% higher. This uneven experience by age, by industry, by firm size and by region will shape the recovery. As we all know, some parts of the country and some industries face very real challenges. We shouldn't, though, lose sight of the fact that other parts of the country and other industries now have new opportunities. The way business is done is also changing, and it's possible that some people and firms living through the pandemic will become more risk-averse, and it's going to affect their appetite to spend and to invest. I think this all means that we are likely to see a period of heightened structural change in our economy. And as a consequence of this, and of the recession we're living through, we will see a pickup in the number of business failures and a pickup in the number of households facing financial stress. How well we support those who are most affected, while at the same time capitalising on the new opportunities that are out there, will shape the recovery over the next few years. I'd now like to move to a third factor that will shape the recovery, and that is how willing people and businesses are to draw on their accumulated financial buffers to spend and invest over the months ahead. One of the many unique features of this recession is that it's been associated with a big increase in household saving. Normally in a recession, income falls and people draw on their savings to get through the hard times. But in the June quarter, when fears about the pandemic were at their peak, the household saving rate surged to 20%. It's the highest rate in almost 50 years, so it's quite different to the normal pattern we see in recessions. There are a couple of factors at work here. The first is that Australians were more cautious and had fewer opportunity to spend, given that many services were simply unavailable. As these opportunities to spend on services disappeared, households did adjust their spending patterns, and they spent more on electronics and exercise equipment and home office equipment, and they spent more online. But this substitution was not enough to offset the very large drop in spending on services, and as you can see here, there was a record decline in consumption in the June quarter. The second factor behind this big increase in savings was the large boost to incomes from the various government support programs. Social assistance benefits, including the JobSeeker payments, increased by nearly $15 billion in the June quarter. In addition, businesses received more than $30 billion in JobKeeper payments to support the wages of their staff. These payments are equivalent to around 15% of total household disposable income
in a typical quarter. It's a very large amount.
Many households have used this extra income and their increased savings to put their balance sheets on firmer footing. Some of the money withdrawn from superannuation funds under the early release scheme, which is now equivalent to around 10% of quarterly household disposable income, again, a very large amount. Some of this extra money has been used to pay down debt and to strengthen cash buffers. The impact of all this can be seen in some of the banking data. As is evident here, over recent months, there's been record rates of repayment on personal credit cards. Interest-bearing credit card balances have fallen by 22% since March, and they're now at the lowest rate in around 15 years, so there's been a very large change here. For many people with a mortgage, much of the extra saving and some of the superannuation withdrawals have been used to increase their balances in their offset accounts, with offset balances up 10% since March. Combined, all forms of mortgage payments, including the additional balances in these offset accounts, reached a record high over recent months, and that's despite repayments being deferred on around 8 to 10% of housing loans. So again, a very large change in household balance sheets. The question that this all raises is, what are people going to do with this extra saving and their improved debt situation? In aggregate, household income is likely to decline in the December quarter as unemployment increases and government support programs become more targeted. In normal times, a decline in income would be expected to affect consumption, but as we all know, these are not normal times. It's entirely possible that as restrictions ease further, people choose to draw on their accumulated buffers to sustain and increase their spending. Many businesses face a similar choice to households. Many have boosted their cash flows over the past 6 months, and they face a decision about what to do with these extra cash buffers. Do they sit on these buffers in case something goes wrong? Or do they use them for spending and expansion? The better outcome for the economy clearly is for households and businesses to keep spending and investing. I think the key to this is the confidence in the health situation and the future state of the economy. If people are nervous about the health situation and they're nervous about their job prospects, they're likely to sit on their savings. On the other hand, if they are confident that the virus can be successfully contained and that they will have a job, they will use these savings to spend and I think they'll keep spending. This means that there are large payoffs to be had from ensuring public confidence in the capacity of the health system to respond. From this perspective alone, there are likely to be large returns from public investments in first-class testing, contact tracing, and quarantining arrangements. These are essential not only to open up the economy successfully, but also to build the confidence that's required for people to spend and for businesses to invest. Economic policy also has a critical role to play here in reducing uncertainty about the future. So I'd now like to turn to economic policy. The policy response to the pandemic has been central to Australia getting through the pandemic, getting through the past 6 months in better shape than almost any other Western country. In previous downturns, it was monetary policy that played the leading role. But this time it's been fiscal policy that's taken the lead. This switch is entirely appropriate given the pandemic and the low interest rate world we're living in. The fiscal response has been crucial to helping build that bridge to the recovery that I spoke about earlier. The income support provided by the government has assisted many people get through this difficult period, it's kept many businesses afloat, and it's reduced some of the unevenness of the pandemic. Fiscal policy has been supported in this effort by monetary policy and by the actions of the banks and the financial regulators. The recent budget provided welcome further support to the economy. The various measures in the budget will provide ongoing support to disposable incomes and they will help boost aggregate demand. Policies of a structural nature will also help build the road to the recovery that I spoke about earlier. I expect that this will help reinforce what I hope to be improving confidence on the health front over the months ahead.
this fiscal support necessarily involves increased borrowing. For a country that became used to low budget deficits and low levels of public debt, this is quite a change. But it's a change that's entirely manageable, and it's a change that's affordable, and it's the right thing to do in the national interest. Debt levels across all levels of government in Australia relative to the size of our economy are much lower than in most other countries, and they're likely to remain much lower. So this is manageable and it's affordable. The national balance sheet is in a strong position and it is able to provide the support that's now required. The Australian government can borrow at the lowest rate ever, and the demand for investors by government bonds is very strong. The states and territories can also borrow at record low interest rates, and they too have an important role to play in the national fiscal response. No doubt there will be a point in the future when attention will need to return to the task of rebuilding the fiscal buffers to deal with the next downturn. This task will be easier when additional government spending is temporary in nature, as most of it is. In any case, the best way to rebuild these buffers is through economic growth. And this means that structural reforms that drive growth will need to remain high on our national agenda. I would now like to turn to monetary policy, which has also played an important supporting role. The package of measures announced in March, including the target for the yield on three-year Australian government bonds, has led to record low funding costs, and it's eased the burden for many people in the society. The RBA's open market operations and the term funding facility have both contributed to a plentiful supply of liquidity in the Australian financial system, and this is supporting the supply of credit to both households and businesses. This will be especially important as we move further into the recovery phase. These measures to support the Australian economy have resulted in a very large increase in the RBA's balance sheet, as you can see in this final graph. Between 2016 and this year, early this year, our balance sheet averaged around $170 billion. Today it's almost double this at over $300 billion. At its September meeting, the Reserve Bank Board decided to expand the term funding facility to provide ADIs with additional low-cost funding equivalent to 2% of their total lending. The timing of this decision coincided with the approach of the deadline for final drawings under the initial allocations under the facility. As ADIs draw on this expanded facility, there will be a further significant expansion of our balance sheet. This expanded facility should be seen as a further easing of monetary policy, although it's not in the way that we've become used to. At its most recent meeting, the board continued to consider the case for additional monetary easing to support jobs and the overall economy. As part of this discussion, we also considered the nature of our forward guidance regarding the cash rate. Before turning to the broader policy question, I'd like to discuss how the board's thinking on forward guidance has evolved. The board agreed that it made sense for me to talk about this today, where more context can be provided, rather than make a change in the statement directly after the board meeting. Over recent months, our communication has stated that the board, and here I quote from our statement, will not increase the cash rate target until progress is being made towards full employment and it's confident that inflation will be sustainably within the 2 to 3% target band. Now, it might seem strange to some that we're even talking about the day when interest rates increase again, given that's so far away. But expectations about future interest rates do affect people's decisions and they do affect asset pricing. So we seek to be as transparent as we possibly can. In terms of inflation, our forward guidance has been forward-looking. We focused on the outlook for inflation, not just current inflation. This was a sensible approach when the inflation dynamics were relatively stable and were well understood as they were. In today's world, things seem much less certain. So we will now be putting a greater weight on actual, not forecast inflation in our decision making. In terms of unemployment, we want to see more than just progress towards full employment. The board views addressing the high rate of unemployment as an important national priority, as does the government. Consistent with our mandate, we want to do what we can with the tools that we have to ensure that people have jobs. We want to see a return to labour market conditions that are consistent with inflation being sustainably within the 2 to 3% target range. So the board will not be increasing the cash rate until actual inflation is sustainably within the target range. It's not enough for inflation to be forecast to be in the target range. While inflation can move up and down for a range of temporary reasons, achieving inflation that's sustainably consistent with the target is likely to require a return to a tight labour market. On our current outlook for the economy, which we'll update in early November, this is still some years away. So we do not expect to be increasing the cash rate for at least 3 years. Turning to the broader policy question, we've been considering what more we can do to support jobs, incomes and businesses in Australia and to help build that important road to the recovery. The options have been laid out in previous speeches by the Deputy Governor and myself, and I don't plan to elaborate on those again today. While the board has not yet made any final decisions, I thought it might be useful today to close by highlighting three of the many issues that we're currently working through. The first is how much traction any further monetary easing might get in terms of better economic outcomes. When the pandemic was at its worst, and there were severe restrictions on activity, we judged that there was little to be gained from further monetary easing. The solutions to the problems the country faced lay elsewhere. But as the economy opens up, it is reasonable to expect that further monetary easing could get more traction than was the case earlier in the year. A second issue is the possible effect of further monetary easing on financial stability and longer-term macroeconomic stability. This is an issue that we paid close attention to in the past, and we have when we've considered reducing interest rates in a relatively robust economic environment. It remains an important issue today, but the considerations have changed somewhat. To the extent that an easing of monetary policy helps people get jobs, it will help private sector balance sheets and it will lessen the number of problem loans. In so doing, it can reduce financial stability risks. This benefit needs to be weighed against any additional risks as people take on more investment risk in the search for yield, and we also need to take into account the effect of low interest rates on people who rely on interest income. The third issue is what is happening internationally with monetary policy. As you know, Australia is a mid-sized open economy in an interconnected world, so what happens abroad has an impact here on both our exchange rate and... So what happens abroad has an impact both here on our exchange rate and our yield curve. In the past, the interest differentials provide a reasonable gauge to the relative stance of monetary policy across countries. Today, things aren't so straightforward, with monetary policy also working through balance sheet expansion. As I noted earlier, our balance sheet has increased considerably since March, but larger increases have occurred elsewhere in the world. We are considering the implications of this as we work through our current options. So these are three of the complex issues that we've been considering in our recent board meetings. The board will continue to review these and other issues at our upcoming meetings. We are committed to do what we reasonably can with the tools we have to support jobs and the recovery of the Australian economy. So thank you for listening. More importantly, for those in the room, thank you for being here, and I look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Governor. Would you like to take that seat there?
This one here?
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay, for the virtual audience, if you can go onto Slido and put some questions in there. Governor, I'll start with a question myself and then we'll go to the room and then we'll see what comes through on the Slido, okay. So it's been a week since Treasury released the federal budget. In your opinion, was the magnitude and timing of the announced spending measures meaningful for removing the concern that some people would say would be termed as a fiscal cliff?
Well, I don't want to kind of comment on the specifics of the budget, but I think the strategy is right. As both the Treasurer and the Prime Minister have identified, creating jobs as a priority. And you look at the entirety of the budget, I think it's going to do that. The continuing income support to people will help. As people have this income, they will spend it. And that will help create jobs. There are initiatives to create jobs directly through public spending on infrastructure and public health. There are also incentives for businesses to expand, invest and hire people. That will help. And there are some structural reforms in the budget which hopefully give business confidence that the economy will grow. So I think you put all that together, there's enough there to give me confidence that this will be enough to kind of get the recovery going and continue. I would like to see the states play a role in the fiscal response as well. For those of you who've been reading the media, you've seen a national cabinet meeting. I suggested to the states that it would be good if they increased their spending by an additional 2% of GDP. There's been some progress on that front. I'd like to see further progress, but I think fiscal response, broadly speaking, has been what the country needed.
Thank you. All right, we'll take from the audience. The microphone, please.
Good morning, everyone. This is Rory Robertson. I'm an economist at Westpac Group Treasury. Governor Lowe, thank you for your important update today. Former Treasurer and Prime Minister Paul Keating was recently highly critical of the bank for supposedly not doing enough. You've showed a chart of the bank's balance sheet that shows the Reserve Bank's done plenty. The question is, like, has it done enough? You've said today, just a moment ago, that but larger increases in balance sheets have occurred in other countries. We are considering the implications of this as we work through our own options. In July, you mentioned that the Reserve Bank was open to the idea of possibly doing a QE program where longer-term government debt might be bought over and above what's needed to satisfy the three-year yield target. My question is about, like, how would you design such a QE program? I imagine that the federal government's budget and the state budgets in the past month or so have given you a sense that there's something like, you know, more than $500 billion of extra government debt going to be in the market in the next few years. How would the bank go about designing a program? Is it a matter of calibrating it to the size of government debt? What would a sensible QE program look like in terms of regular purchases of government debt? Is simply how would you go about designing such a thing?
Well, I'm not going to kind of speculate on that because we haven't yet decided to go down this route. So obviously we've had internal discussions how we do this, and I'm confident that if we take the decision to do this, then we can do it, and we do it sensibly. We've studied the experience of other countries. We know what works, and we know what doesn't work so well. And one of the factors that we've been focusing on is that our three-year interest rates, three-year government interest rates, are pretty much the same as everywhere else around the world. Our 10-year yields are higher than almost every other Western country. So our 10-year yields, I think this morning, are kind of 80, maybe 85, and in many other countries, they're 60, 50, and obviously in Europe and Japan, they're either zero or negative. But our 10-year yields are higher than almost everywhere in the world. The Reserve Bank has not bought bonds in the 5 to 10-year range, except for in early March. So we're trying to understand whether those two things are related. The fact that we've got higher 10-year bond yields than the rest of the world, is that related to the fact that we're not buying their bond, buying bonds at that maturity? And if that's the reason, is there benefit in having those interest rates come down as we try and support jobs? So that's the issue we're grappling with. I think the design of a program is, if we decide to do this, is relatively straightforward. The bigger question is, what benefit do we get from it?
Thank you very much.
One more from the audience.
Jonathan Shapiro from the Financial Review. As is often the case, you've just answered my question before I got to answer it, which was if you could expand on considering the implications when you mentioned interest rate differentials in a world of balance sheet expansion. So perhaps you could expand a little bit more on that and what you're considering, and if we should read into that you're moving a step closer towards increasing bond purchases along the curve with the view to perhaps easing upward pressure on the exchange rate. And also, if you could discuss whether, if you're weighing off expansion of the balance sheet via the TFF versus buying more bonds along the higher up the curve, and if you've weighed off the relative efficacy in achieving your monetary policy objectives. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, we expanded the TFF in September. Banks can now borrow the equivalent of 5% of their total lending under that facility, and some banks can borrow even more if they've expanded their business credit. At least at the moment, I don't see very much room to do further on that front. So the question that's before us is there benefit in us buying bonds further out along the yield curve, let's say the 5 to 10-year range? What effect would that have on the longer-term interest rates? What effect would it have on the exchange rate? And the equally important question is, if there were effects on longer-term interest rates and the exchange rate, what benefit would we get at that in terms of jobs? Because jobs is our main focus at the moment. So the question the board's working through, and it's a difficult question, is if we buy government bonds in the 5 to 10 year range, is that going to create more jobs? And how would it create more jobs? This is why we're taking our time to work through that issue. It's a very important issue, but it's also quite complex. We're taking our time, but that's what we're discussing at every one of our meetings. I think on the TFF, we've done what we reasonably can there.
Okay, it looks like we've got 43 seconds. Maybe just there's been a bit of inflation coming through on slide A, so just quickly, Governor. Given Japan and the past 12 years, there's been no guarantee that inflation can be increased to the desired levels. What is being considered should this be a reality?
Well, I think I've just talked about the things that are under consideration, kind of us buying bonds further out along the yield curve, and it's also possible to reduce the interest rates that are currently at 25 basis points down to 10. So these are adjustments that we're currently working through and asking what effect it would have. But realistically, they're not going to be the things that drive inflation quickly back to 2.5%. So the question, or a longer-term question we're also considering, is how does the inflation targeting framework sit in this world that we're currently living in? We've had some difficulty over recent years of averaging inflation at 2%, and the pandemic is going to make that much more difficult. So what role does that have? And that role has to evolve over time. But what doesn't really evolve are the core objectives of the Reserve Bank, and they're set out in legislation that was very wisely written back in 1959. That's price stability, full employment, and the economic welfare of the people of Australia. So there's some constants, and those constants are going to continue to drive us. But as it becomes more difficult to control inflation in a narrow range, we will have to evolve how we operate monetary policy, and the evolution, our thinking about forward guidance that I talked about today, is part of that broader evolution. But I expect over time you'll see more. But you won't see this change the very broad focus on price stability, full employment, and the welfare of the people. That's ultimately what's important.